it might be very helpful to sometimes stop and think, do we really need all this? And that would be something I would love to explore, to say, can we also not design? What does it mean to ex-novate a product?
Welcome to Design Perspectives, a podcast by the German Design Council. I'm Katharina De Silva, Editor-in-Chief, and in this podcast we explore the potential of design, architecture and innovation. Now I'll hand over to our host, Martin Pauli.
Welcome to a new episode of Design Perspectives. My name is Martin Pauli. Today's conversation is one I've been particularly looking forward to, as it brings us right to the foundation of circular design and how we can turn it into practice. Connie Becker is a professor of circular product design at TU Delft and one of the key voices shaping how designers think about circularity today. For many years, she's been working on translating the idea of a circular economy into concrete design strategies, from extending product life cycles to rethinking systems of use, ownership, and value creation. Her work challenges us to move beyond incremental improvements and to fundamentally rethink how we design not just individual products, but the systems they are part of. Welcome, Connie.
Hi, Martin. Great to be here.
Connie, you've been working on circular design long before it became mainstream. Can you tell us what kind of first drew you on this field?
Very nice question. I think what first drew me, it was back in 1989 when I was graduating from the Faculty of Industrial Design in Delft. And in that year, the first big newspaper headlines appeared about global warming. And in those days, acid rain was still an issue. And I read those and I realized that all through my studies, excellent studies, industrial design in Delft, I had not been asked any questions about environmental impacts of my work. And I realized at that point that I wanted to do something with it. And that sort of that realization and that passion has stayed with me ever since.
So, and looking back and kind of looking back to this particular moment, why did you then realize that the way we design products and systems fundamentally need to change?
Oh, well, I think the systems aspect came a bit later. Mm. Initially, it was just like, oh my goodness, we have been taught how to design beautiful products that people love to use and to design them smartly so that they can be cheap or at least affordable and that they are wonderful to use. But we have never, ever been asked to give any consideration to what happens after use. They just, as was in our methods, they just disappear. So they literally disappeared from consciousness of designers in those days. It was just not an option, not an issue to think about. So bringing that perspective first, so what happens to products after use? How can they be reused? How can they be repaired? How can they be recycled? Was the beginning. And later, I guess I began to realize that that requires an entire system shift.
Yeah, which kind of we now refer to as the circular economy, and not kind of going beyond the circular design itself.
Yes, indeed.
So you said 1989.
Yes.
Yeah. So now, 30 years later, more than 30 years later, what still keeps you optimistic that this is the right agenda and that there's hope when at the same time the progress sometimes can feel a bit slow?
Yes, not just feel a bit slow. The progress is slow. It feels a little bit like, you know, one step forward, two steps back sometimes, especially in the last couple of years, it has been hard. Yeah, what keeps me optimistic sometimes, that is a big challenge, to stay optimistic in the face of a world that seems to be turning away from the climate crisis and from sustainability as an urgent topic. I guess what keeps me optimistic is my patience. And having been part of an academic environment for a long time teaches you to be extremely patient. Because when I returned to TU Delft. It took me 8 years to get a course, a mandatory course in our bachelor on design for sustainability. 8 years. And so that taught me that TU Delft is also a system that needs to change, but change is always slow and very incremental. And I guess in a small way, TU Delft is a representation of the rest of the world. So if it takes 8 years to get a simple course, it will take so much longer to get something changed in the real world.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that because everyone is talking about like constant disruption. And it has become a buzzword. But what you say somehow, as you say, reflects reality, obviously, much more. We are often much more talking about incremental change and we wish that it would be faster. But at the same time, not every human being likes change. It likes to transform. And I think that's what we need to navigate collectively.
Totally, yes. And yes, and I guess that most of the time change is incremental and slow. And as I said, one step forward, two steps back. But there are, of course, disruptive moments. And we had one during COVID, which was actually quite exciting in a weird way. And we have now a very disruptive moment with the war in the Middle East, which really makes people think about fossil fuel dependency. Yeah. And so that is actually interesting. So there may be a weird silver lining there where we actually start considering, should we decrease our dependence? And that might just open up a window of opportunity again for, you know, renewable energy, circularity.
Yeah. And it's interesting because, I mean, that has been for so many years also completely abstract that oil and polymers are basically the kind of the foundation of many of today's product design. It's literally in everything. And for us as kind of experts, consultants, designers, this kind of we could make that connection. But for the majority of people, they don't necessarily see that. Yeah. And all of a sudden, these also international dependencies become much more visible.
Yeah, it has been very, very, very clear since the war in Ukraine started that these supply chain disruptions have started to happen, and it has put at least policymakers on the alert. Yeah. But it's only and some companies are feeling it, but it's only very slowly. How do you say that, trickling down into the design profession? I'm not aware of design consultancies being asked to deal with critical raw materials, for instance, although I do think they should.
So let's go kind of take a bit of a step back again and kind of somehow bridge that gap from theory to practice and help also the listeners to understand in your eyes and also with your experience, academic, professional experience. Circularity is a widely discussed topic. But you and I and many others know sometimes it can remain a bit abstract. So what's your definition of circular design in very practical terms?
Yes. So I come from a product design background. So when people ask me questions like that or students, I usually explain it through a product. So I'm basically saying, how can we make products last longer? How can we make sure that the products and the materials in the product can cycle? Preferably indefinitely through reuse, remanufacturing, refurbishment, recycling. And then once you start thinking of a product in such a circular system, you begin to realize that it means that you have to take on board supply chains, consumer preferences, and business models. And then quickly you get into a more complex definition. But as a starting point, just talking about cycling the materials and the components of a product for a very long time is a helpful starting point for many designers.
And reflecting a bit on the kind of on that epic career in product design and teaching and circularity, did the questions of students change over time?
Not really, actually. I get to see a new generation every year. Uh-huh. A little in the beginning, there was still a little bit of that climate denialism. And so why do we need to learn this? Is it really a problem? That has completely changed. So I used to have these classes where we actually had a big discussion on climate science and the way climate denialism manifested itself. That's gone. Mm-hmm. So now everybody seems to be like, yeah, this is clearly an issue. What can we do about it? I think the second thing, for a very long time, students thought indeed it was really abstract and a bit far away from their lived experience. But through classes on things like product repair, so where we do product dismantling sessions and teach students how awfully many products are designed, that really brings it to a level that they can relate, and that really gets them going. I find that simple thing, like putting a product in their hands and telling them, take this apart and tell me what you think, all of a sudden connects it to their lived reality.
Yeah.
And in that sense, indeed, I think they usually ask the question, and that's been true for many years, what does it mean for me?
A designer.
And so that finding as a designer, but also as a person. Yeah. And so they in the beginning, they do have a difficulty making that distinction because they are not yet fully trained designers. Yeah. So,
and it's interesting. I mean, to some extent, they probably also need to make that pivot from being a product designer to becoming a systems designer that has the full supply and value chain, that understands it and is almost kind of able to control and design certain parts of it. Is that landing step by step?
Step by step. And it's a huge challenge. And sometimes it even overwhelms me. So we are now slowly building this sort of approach through bachelor and master, mm-hmm. where by the time they become master thesis students, so at the capstone project of their career, their student's career, they are able to take on board that more systemic perspective where they have to think about business models, about consumer acceptance, about product architecture. So we're seeing that coming. Mm-hmm. It is a complex one to embed carefully in a 6-year education trajectory, but I think it can be done.
Yeah, and you're right. I mean, this is something that kind of as soon as they're in their professional career and in that reality, these are implications that they will have to deal with anyway. So it will be a lifelong learning journey, I believe, because even very established companies and organizations are not necessarily always aware of that imperative.
Totally, yes. There's a lot of learning, postgraduate learning to be done as well, actually.
Yeah.
We are not done yet.
No. That's an ongoing journey. Where do you see the biggest gap today between kind of the circular ambition that we could kind of easily frame and the real implementation? I know that's a difficult question.
The biggest gap is again what we've talked about, that systemic approach. Yeah. So many companies, but designers as well, they mistake circularity for recycling or something, and they make a few bespoke changes to a product, if that much. For instance, they make an internal component out of recycled plastics, an invisible internal component, and then they do a bit of greenwashing, and we are so circular. That is, of course, it's at least it's something. It's a step, but that it doesn't do justice to the complexity of going circular.
I mean, framing it in a positive way, what we've seen and what you might have also seen is that kind of especially organizations start doubling down on what's within their control, which is to kind of rethink maybe procurement and the product design itself and changing the design. But then as soon as this kind of has wider implications, financial, economic, and also supply chain, and also downstream to the customers, then the complexity usually kicks in.
And I'm not trying to say that that's not a good development, starting to use recycled plastics, because I know from practice that it is already difficult enough to source those and to make sure that you get a steady supply of recycled plastics of a certain quality. The cost implications are there. It is so I can imagine that companies sell it as such. But looking at the way we teach circularity and the implications for a systemic change, and then seeing that reflected in one component made of recycled plastics is sometimes a bit disheartening from an academic perspective.
So if I work, would work at a company, let's say an SME that is known for fantastic products and product design, and we embark now as a company on the circularity journey. We have understood it might be a lever to also kind of decarbonize our footprint and so on and so forth. Based on your experience, what is the most common mistake I can avoid immediately?
The most common mistake is, I think, trying to do everything at once. So I have worked with companies who were totally into circularity, and we developed a very cool value proposition for their products, like taking their products back, refurbishing them, selling them again, if you like, or putting out a lease model. And they really loved it. And they said, well, we're going to do it. And then they got bogged down by the very complexity of making such a change. If you are a company selling products and all of a sudden you become, well, an excess provider, if you like, then the change is massive. You need to completely rethink the way you communicate with your consumers, the way you do contracting, the way you actually start earning revenue, the way you design your product, the way you refurbish it, the standards around it. Everything changes, and that is too much for in one go. So you have to take it step by step.
Yeah, I mean, everything you said implies nothing else than a fundamental change to your business model that you have probably established over decades.
Exactly.
And you've kind of treated for and then optimized it for efficiencies and all that. And now you're saying, hey, let's not redesign the product. Let's redesign and rethink literally every aspect of our business. And you're right, that can be overwhelming. And also getting the buy-in from your stakeholders internally, externally from your customers. That's where also we've seen concepts failing.
Exactly. Even if the value proposition is strong, because if you do it smartly and if you do it well, you might be able to sell your own products twice, if you like, to put it very down to earth. But there are also interesting ways that you can develop such a circular system to open up new markets, to really add value to the product that you have for people. So companies often see that, but then actually getting it done in practice is a huge ask.
Yeah, and also making it commercially viable. We've often seen examples where kind of ultimately, the business case was not necessarily visible, mainly because there was no economy of scale, which requires the entire system. And then we are in that systems transformation journey, which might take, I don't know, 20, 30 years.
But scale is a big thing.
You mentioned kind of the next life cycle. That seems to be obviously kind of a core idea in your work, that design for multiple life cycles, which is pretty much also the DNA of circular systems. So going back to kind of what's within the control of a designer or a design department in an organization, what does it require in practice?
To design for multiple life cycles?
Yeah.
For a designer in practice, it requires, given that they have that space to actually think this way, because often they don't when the assignment is not geared towards such. So if they can take a little bit of thinking space, it's often very, stimulating to think longer term about your product. So what would be the possibility to put it in the market in such a way that it can last longer and that it keeps, you know, delivering value over time? And what needs to be done to the product in order to ensure that this happens? For designers, it can be extremely a grateful or a thankful process to do so.
Rewarding,
because it stimulates creativity. Rewarding, that was the word. Yeah. For designers, it can be a truly rewarding process because it does stimulate creativity. If you have to think over not just, 2 years, but over a decade, and that's just taking that mind shift is opens up new horizons, which is cool.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the same also at a building scale or even city scale, it opens an entirely new world of creativity and collaboration and all that. So yes,
indeed, yeah,
we can become very enthusiastic. The question to the question of ownership, you touched on it already. Of course, like we are familiar with kind of product as a service business models or the overall like service economy. That is obviously linked. So how would you say the concepts like repair, reuse, remanufacturing change the way we think about the ownership of a product? Is that the fundamental precondition or not?
No, it's a very interesting question because when we started with the whole circular economy concept, we were very convinced that, we should move away from ownership. But I have actually come to think a bit differently about that over time. Because it is, if you only would have access models like rental or lease or these kind of, subscription models, we have seen in practice that there is a very dark side to that.
With bikes, for instance.
So those with bikes, yeah, that's a thing. But also the thinking of those companies who give access can also take it away. Or if a company goes out of business, you're stuck with a service that is no longer available. So there are all aspects that can make access models actually, well, there's huge rebound effects, let me put it that way. So I think there's something to be said for having ownership of products and people actually truly value it. But then we have to be smart about how to keep circulating products if people own them and keep them, which in a way we want, but we also want to circulate them. So how do we get people to say goodbye to their products in a good way?
It's interesting that you say that because obviously there are different like product or design or ownership archetypes. I mean, the good old Eames lounge chair, you probably better want to own it, but your fridge, probably you don't have an emotional relationship to it. So, and that somehow determines the way that ownership could be designed. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Absolutely, yes. And there's actually quite only a few products that would work well in a non-ownership setting. I think we still very much are attached to having stuff and to being able to feel that things are yours, to create an emotional connection with your products. And that's very difficult if you don't own them.
Yeah. But at the same time, like the laptop that we're looking at both now, I don't necessarily know if I need to have that feeling every morning that I own that.
Mine isn't even mine. It's that you don't. Just, I have to return it.
As one example. So and that seems to be the red line, of course. Circularity is not only related to product and product design, but kind of there is that huge systems implication. Kind of looking at your also kind of academic career and also the work with students and designers, what's within their control to better engage with business model thinking and value chains? How can they become those systems designer?
Yeah, I think we're in this sort of transition phase at the moment where we are moving away from purely product design to becoming, to actually also putting, let's say, framing design as a systems business, if you like. Training our students to start thinking more. We call it systemic design in those terms, to become, sometimes we call it systems orchestrators. It's we're still very much learning what that means and what kind of competencies we need our designers to develop, because we don't want to give up the materiality of what it means to design a product, the aesthetics and the knowledge of the product architecture. Yeah. But at the same time, we see that without having that systemic knowledge and being able to engage with the system around the products, you won't have any impact, or very little impact at least.
Yeah. And I completely get that. It also reminds me a bit on the role of architects maybe 30 years ago and now. So they have always been like orchestrators, as you say, that or kind of directors, basically directing individual instruments so that there is one kind of sound that makes sense. And in a way, they have been facilitating all those various different disciplines, and that's now expanding. And that might be an interesting analogy to what the future of product design could look like almost facilitate all those different disciplines. Practically speaking, so can I then imagine that product designers also work with economists and with people from procurement? And
Exactly. We are actually doing that right now. We're working with policymakers. We're working with people from procurement, experiences in a project on sustainable healthcare, where we work with the hospital procurement people to help them, you know, decide what to buy and what not to buy. But it does change your role dramatically. Yes. And you need to become, you know, versant in the language of procurement, or you need to be able to write a policy brief, which requires very different skills. So that's what we are grappling with at the moment, because it dilutes what it means to be a product designer or a designer in general. And so we constantly run up against limits, like, okay, writing a policy brief, shouldn't we let that, we should let that be done by people who can do that really well. So what is our role then? Should we feed those people with our insights? Probably yes. And then still we need to be able to speak that language at least more than we used to be able to. So there is this boundary frontier sort of like where we call it, where we're working inter or transdisciplinary, trying to sort of reach out to other disciplines, work with them, learn their language, but still try to stay true to the core of what it is to be a designer. And this is a transition we're going through in our faculty, and we're really struggling with it actually, because what is our identity?
And what's the identity of a designer? Because it's also a story about potentially like giving up and letting kind of things happen that have been historically within your control. And there's a risk that things dilute too much and there are too many compromises. Yes, but...
Well, yes, and it's a worry of mine as well. Like if we dilute too much beyond product design or product service design or product service experience design, that's what we have been expanding quite a bit over the years, then at some point can we even be recognized as a profession?
It's very interesting. I mean, if the role of a designer kind of... could transition into that role of kind of that mastermind that somehow facilitates that entire process and somehow pulls in all the relevant disciplines and takes many viewpoints on a project. That is super exciting, if you like. You know,
I guess also in its core, that's what was meant with design thinking, maybe.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it is super. And we see the exciting chances of having such a role, such a orchestrator role. But then again, aren't we, you know, being arrogant here? Or aren't we trying to, you know, claim something that is maybe beyond us? So there's those doubts are there as well.
It's also, I mean, ultimately, it's a question of ownership. Someone needs to own that process, if you like. Someone needs to be able to turn all these various elements, perspectives, and disciplines into one coherent piece of a product or a system or a building or a city. And
exactly, yeah.
That can be the role of a designer. I believe many people could live with that very well, also many students. But
it's interesting what you're saying, because indeed, I think now that you mention it, that the architects have worked like that for a long time. They may have lost some of that influence over the years, at least in the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. But designers have, you at least industrial designers, from where I come from, they have been very service-oriented and whatever the client asks, we'll do it. But we need to actually become more, if you like, we need to take more ownership of the process. Yeah.
And there's also a need for these role models, especially in the design world, no? Which there's a strong focus on the individual genius that just sits at their table and kind of draws a perfect line. But the reality is different. No? And I think also the reality for very successful designers out there is completely different. It's much more multidisciplinary. And I think that step-by-step leads to that, especially in the context of like systems design and circular design. Maybe that's an interesting segue also to looking towards like the future generation. I mean, you shaped basically hundreds, if not thousands, of students how to think about circular design. What's the future mindset shift that is going to be most important for that generation?
Ooh, that is a hard question
simple
to
question,
ask.
Connie.
Simple question, not such a simple answer. Future mindset shift. In a way, I think what we just touched upon. How can we educate our designers to become those system orchestrators? That would be a nice one to work towards and to see how we can develop that, at least, let's say, a kernel of that sort of role during the education that we can give them, because it is a big step to we have to learn so many skills along the way. I think we have designers who can do that in our cohort. Not everyone, but for those who are open to it, it might be a very interesting one to start to have that point on the horizon, that ambition, like, can we develop you into a system orchestrator instead of just a product designer? We still need those as well.
Yeah.
But
And is there a risk that people and students can feel overwhelmed because there's too much complexity?
Yes, I am also overwhelmed sometimes, the only way to deal with that is taking it step by step, and slowly, you know, layering on levels of complexity as they are ready, and some can take more than others.
And to be crystal clear, what's within your control, within your remit, and what you can actually, where you can have an impact ultimately. I think this is.
Yeah, but then again. You can push that boundary, right? As you just said. If you accept whatever other people tell you is within your remit, you won't get very far. But if you start pushing those boundaries, start reaching out to politicians, start, you know, building your own company, there is more that you can do. And we also try to get our students to think about entrepreneurship, to think about starting something new, to think about lobbying for issues they find important and how to reach out to politicians. Netherlands is a small country. We can do this.
Yeah, you have been doing it very successfully as a country. I mean, it's a lighthouse country, and then in also many other regards. Yeah. So if we look 10, 15 years ahead now, glimpse into the future, for you personally, what would success for a circular design actually look like?
Whew. I think success means that I know we have to go short, small steps. I think having something in society that normalizes, having sort of this normalization of, you know, that it's normal that products last a long time, that it's normal that they can be repaired, that it's normal that they are recycled in a thorough way. That would be such a big thing already.
Yeah.
So that in order for it
almost becomes mainstream.
In order for that to happen, we do need those system operators and system orchestrators, but just normal people, everyday life is still so extremely wasteful, and we have been so good as a society to shorten product lifespans very insidiously almost. It has become normalized in a way that a washing machine lasts 6 to 8 years instead of 20, a laptop 4 years instead of 12. So to get that back, even that simple thing, is going to be a massive endeavor. And that would be a big gain if we could manage even to shift that mindset. And even if we would get there, it would create fertile ground for building circular systems.
Yeah, and as you also say, we also need to see the evidence in terms of data, volumes, qualities, and quantities of resources being reused, and all that, and all this kind of everything that is written into strategies now. We really need to get the proof points that we are actually achieving those targets step by step. And then many of us won't care whether we are talking about circularity as long as we can achieve these goals. So what is, like, and that's already the last question, unfortunately, that kind of for the last kind of discussion point, what is the one assumption about design or sustainability that you as a professional think we need to change more radically, where we probably need to be more disruptive to?
Yeah, that's a nice one. I think we need to look into sufficiency much more than we're currently doing. So enough is enough, right? So circularity still has a tendency to work with the current system. Many people who are into circularity think that as long as we cycle our materials and our products and our components, we can do more of it, because then it's okay to use more because we recycle and cycle it. But I think that needs to stop. And we are an affluent society, extremely rich in the Northwestern Europe. It's very unpopular to talk about sufficiency, having enough, not making more and not having more. But I think it's a discussion we need to have. And I'm not completely sure how to start that. And it's a very difficult one in a design space to talk about not designing. I think there's something to be said for not innovating, for the whole way of thinking, especially now with the AI revolution, is about, you know, radically accelerating innovation processes. It's sort of like this sort of leap forward into faster, whereas it might be very helpful to sometimes stop and think, do we really need all this? And that would be something I would love to explore in the final stages of my career here in Delft, to say, can we also not design? What does it mean to ex-novate a product?
To be absolutely honest, that sounds very radical.
Yeah, that is.
And that's why it probably needs to be done. And as you say, that might be the kind of the next chapter.
Yeah. You asked something, a radical challenge, right? So this is the most radical in a weird way that I can think of. Yeah.
Connie, we're already at the end of this season. I really enjoyed the conversation with you. I could have deep dived on so many aspects, and we might just kind of continue that offline. But at this stage, I just want to thank you for your time and for your reflections and insights, and also for the fantastic work you've been doing and you are doing. And I wish you all the kind of success and the energy and passion to unlock that next chapter and talk about sufficiency with your students.
Thank you. It was lovely speaking to you.
Thank you for tuning into the Design Perspectives podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe so you don't miss out on future ones. And if you have any questions or feedback, feel free to email us at podcast@gdc.de.